look around and see what you scientists are up to. One thing I would encourage you, those of you who are biologists, which I assume is most of you, is to get involved and think about issues at this interface, at the law and policy and science interface. A lot of times I think biologists, and I know attorneys, judges, when they think about science, they're like, oh, that's science. I really can't think much about that. That's too hard. Well, it's not that hard, and that's kind of my message for you as biologists. You know, we lawyers like to convince you that the law is really hard, because then we can bill $450 an hour for our time, right? We're lawyers. We know about the law. It's really not that hard. It's not rocket science. I mean, if you guys can do the statistical regressions and all of that that you do, figuring out what the law actually says and what the law requires and reading a case that a court has decided, I think you'll find pretty easy. So I encourage you to do that. I'm going to talk about the primary purpose of the U.S. Endangered Species Act. And perhaps not surprisingly, that is to conserve threatened and endangered species. So this is the purposes section of the Endangered Species Act. It's the first section of the law. Of course, to confuse you, we conveniently call that in shorthand, ESA shorthand, Section 2. You can see that the primary purpose, the first one articulated in Section 2, is to conserve threatened and endangered species themselves. Also, the ecosystems upon which they depend, although that is the last time that the term ecosystems appears in the Endangered Species Act. One thing I would encourage you to do when you take a little foray into law and policy is pay particular attention to definitions. That's a lot of what we as attorneys or lawmakers, policy people do is pay attention to definitions. So if the ESA's primary purpose is to conserve listed species, what does that mean? Well, the ESA has a definition section, so I've given you a portion of, not all of, but a portion of the statutory definition of conserve, and that is to bring threatened endangered species to the point where they no longer need the protection of the Endangered Species Act. Of course, we would call that delisting. That's the point at which they can be taken off those protected lists. And so really, the definition of recovery, that's synonymous with conservation, which means getting species to the point where they're sufficiently secure to be delisted. Delistings are in the news right now. Big policy, political, and scientific debates headlined by a charismatic megafauna, gray wolves. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as I'm sure you all know, proposed to delist wolves in their entirety throughout the lower 48 states in the United States. That is making a lot of waves, both in the scientific and legal communities, as well as politically. And I think, the wolf will pop up as we go through many of the presentations today, and I think it's kind of a marquee example of the importance of the notion of delisting, and precisely the question, when is it appropriate to take a species off the list? Wolves are hopping from endangered status, threatened status in their experimental range in central Idaho, right off the list into recovery, despite inhabiting still only a small fraction of their historic range. So that really raises some significant questions, I think. What is recovery? Other species out there, I think, raise those questions as well in pretty profound ways. We like to think that we have had quite a bit of success in recovering California condors, for example. We have two populations of condors flying free, around 200 individuals or so out there. But this species faces continuing problems. We literally have to babysit individual condors, oftentimes capturing them and putting them through this chelation process to clean their blood and to take the lead out of their blood. So really, we see these free-flying condors, and in a sense, they're kind of a ghost species in the sense that that population would disappear pretty quickly unless they literally were babysat. So what does that mean? Where are we? Can we ever recover condors? Is that a political problem? Is that a biological problem? Another really interesting case study, I think. Finally, also, all of this plays out amid what I call 21st century threats to biological diversity. Not necessarily gone, but in the old days, including in 1973 when Congress passed the Endangered Species Act, many people, including even many biologists, saw the question of species imperilment as a very relatively simple cause and effect relationship. The species requires habitat. There's not quite enough habitat. We need to set up some reserves, protect some more habitat. We've recovered the species. Or we need to do something like ban DDT and recover the species. In the 21st century, we've realized that it's much more complicated, unfortunately. Climate change. How do you solve questions of recovery in a context of climate change? Where in recovery, we're looking out decades, and if you do that and attended some of the climate change sessions already, that process is fraught with uncertainty and obviously tremendous difficulty. It plays out amid species invasions by exotic invasive species. This is a python that literally exploded, famous picture, you may have seen it, after it tried to eat an alligator in the Everglades. Pythons are not going away in the Everglades. Many invasive species throughout the country are not going away. How do and can we even recover species in the face of ways that we've entirely changed the species composition of those ecosystems? And even the disturbance regimes in ecosystems have been completely altered by humans. Fire suppression, for example, has massively altered many of our forest ecosystems. How do we or can we restore those disturbance regimes, especially when we build the urban environment out into those forests that may have a relatively frequent fire return interval? That's a place you don't want that kind of a disturbance regime. What does it mean for recovery of species that may rely on those sorts of disturbances for their life cycles? Difficult questions. Here are some factors that, in thinking about recovery, I listed as important to think about. What are we trying to recover? How certain do we want to be that it's going to be around that target of our recovery for some specific period of time? Where do we want it? Gray wolves, an obvious case in point for that. Where do we want wolves? How widespread do we want them to be? They used to exist almost literally throughout the lower 48 states. What do we want in the future? What should be human roles in that recovery, not only getting us to recovery, but also maintaining that recovery? Carlos, in particular, is going to talk about that issue, especially in the context of so-called conservation-reliant species. And then, how do we actually get to recovery and maintain recovery for a lot of those species, particularly in light of modern political and financial constraints? Let's look at the first question. What are the targets of our recovery? Well, in order to do this, delisting is really the converse of listing, right? You're either putting a species on the list or you're taking it off the list, but you have to cross essentially the same line. And so what are the targets that we are listing or delisting? What units of biological diversity are we talking about? The ESA's definition of species originally, you can see in 1979, just referred to species or taxa below that interbreed with mature. It was changed in 1979 to introduce this notion of listing species and subspecies, but also something called distinct population segments. Even the question of species has recently come up. We now suddenly realize that there are at least three species of gray wolves, or at least some scientists assert now that there are three different species of gray wolves throughout the lower 48. Very interesting science question, but also difficult line drawing question in the context of science. And is there any policy in there? Very interesting question, I think. The National Marine Fisheries Service first took a crack at defining the second step, distinct population segments under the Endangered Species Act. That's very important because we list and delist and therefore have to recover distinct units of biological diversity on a distinct population segment basis, a DPS basis. So defining that is really important. This is how NIMS did it for Pacific Salmonid DPS policy in 1996. You can see in particular that a distinct population has to be discrete. Number one, essentially markedly separated from other populations, and it must be significant in some way. What does that mean? Well, that question has some really important real-world consequences. Right now, there's litigation going on over bald eagles in the Sonora Desert area. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has said they are discrete but not significant. So we could lose bald eagles throughout the Southwest, and according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, that's not a problem. What are the listing and delisting thresholds? How imperiled does something have to be, or how secure, going the other way, does something have to be before we list it or delist it? These are the statutory definitions and a regulatory definition. You can see that at least biologically they're sort of singularly unenlightening. That's led to us listing or delisting different critters depending on whether they're mammals or not. Mammals tend to get listed when they face less risk than something like reptiles or plants. Recovery plans, the statute requires, based on 1988 amendments, are important because if you look at the middle requirement for recovery plan contents, they are supposed to contain objective measurable criteria which define recovery. So if we really want to define the degree of security that we're looking to shoot for in recovering listed species, we're supposed to look at the recovery plans themselves. Courts have said, however, that the measures in recovery plans are not very enforceable. And a recent court decision out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals involving this critter has led to an interesting position by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, where the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says that the agency can ignore even its own recovery plans in defining what a recovered species is. So now we can't really even look to a recovery plan to define what recovery is. It's just whatever the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it is. Where should species be? That really is playing out in this context of the Endangered Species Act. Significant portion of the range in the definition of endangered species. What is a significant portion of the range of a species? According to the agency, we look not to a species' historic range, but to its current range. Tends toward a museum piece approach to recovery. Finally, Carlos is going to get into this question. Right now, we barge salmon in the Northwest past dams, so you can be passed on Highway 84 by migrating salmon. We move wolves around between populations, not through natural migration, but through capturing them and putting them somewhere else in order to exchange genetics between populations. Is that what we want for listed species? And finally, Brett is going to talk about implementing recovery in this very difficult time budgetarily, which really determines on the ground what gets implemented and what doesn't. So hopefully that will be an overview that set up the rest of the panel. Thank you very much.